Dean Cook, friends, thank you very much for your thoughtfulness. I have moved into the digital photography business, but not at the camera level. I've been using conventional silver-based photography and then scanning negatives and slides into my computer and manipulating them and printing them from there. And the quality that's possible that way is just enormous. And I know that the new cameras that have become available have, over the last couple of years, have moved very rapidly into a much higher quality level than they were even 2 or 3 years ago. So thank you very much for your thoughtfulness. And Dean Cook sent me some photographs that he had of him and me together just a couple of days ago by email. And I hope before long maybe I can send you back something with this red box. Thank you very much. I hope you will forgive me for sitting down tonight. I have two doctors here. One is my daughter, who's the director of the Gannett Clinic in the Cornell Health Service. And when she says, sit down, I sit. My other doctor is Dr. Fred Plum, who was one of the speakers this afternoon, who, for longer than my time, has been the chief neurologist at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center in New York, and now is retired from that position and is a university professor there. He's been looking after me for 30 years, and he told me to sit down. So here I am. I don't know how to respond to such a warm and generous affair as this tonight. It's easy for me to say I don't believe all the stuff you heard. I have respect from the people who said it, and they don't often lie about things. I think the wine got to them a little bit tonight. Getting up in the morning, going to work, and trying to do my job as well as I could would not seem to call for an occasion like this. And who would ever want to make a video of me? We once had an alumnus who had 13 surgical procedures for a complex malignancy before he died in his 90s. And he said, they just practice on me. They save the real thing for someone more deserving. And I think that applies here. I think the filmmakers were just practicing on me. I thank David Rose and Molly Cummings and their associates for this film. And I think they're here someplace. Would you stand up? And I would like also to recognize our own Cornell producers of the film, Ed Hersey and Carol Stone. Would you stand up? Ed Hersey has many professions. He's just been elected to the Common Council in Ithaca for a second term, defeating a Cornell undergraduate. Now he's going to start practicing up for the next election, where he'll undoubtedly have to run against a graduate student. All I can say to you is thank you for your kindness. Nellie and I are both pleased, of course, but embarrassed. I particularly thank Jean Gortzik for what she said about Nellie. I'm especially grateful for that. Thank you, Jean. I can tell you a story. Jean related the trees that were dedicated to Nellie, and Jean read the plaque that went with the gift of the trees when she was standing right beside me, and I could read it as she was talking, and I could see there was an error, a mistake in the casting. And I wondered what Jean is going to do when she gets to that point. She got to the point where it was the wrong word or the wrong spelling or some mistake, and she handled it very well. She didn't hesitate more than about a millisecond and kept right on going, but she didn't let anybody see the plaques. She took it right away and had it recast. That plaque is over in front of Balch dormitories, if you'd like to go over and see it sometime near the trees. I also, I want to thank the outside speakers for coming and talking about questions that are at the top of our national agenda in what I thought was an extraordinary series of talks today. I'm impressed. And all of the people who had anything to do with selecting the speakers, I congratulate you. I particularly thank Dean Cook and Vice Provost Richardson, who were the chief organizers of this event. And I was going to thank Tina Sneed for all that she's done to put the pieces together, and she's been particularly helpful to me in my part of this affair. And there was a formal organization committee, which I think never met as a whole committee. We met as pieces at different times, and Tina is the one that made all this committee work come out the way it has today. Tina's already been recognized, but you could stand up again, Tina. I remind everyone here, however, that our chief mission in this affair is to look forward to the future. Satchel Paige, one of my baseball heroes, said, "Never look back. Something might be gaining on you." I always tried to operate on principle, and over time I developed a set of administrative principles that I've talked about at other times, but I'd like to relate some of these principles to you tonight. One, the principle of fences and bases. It takes less time to touch bases than it does to mend fences. The impossibility of solution. Most problems, if not all, are impossible to solve. All you can do is resolve the issues. Number three, the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. The principle of necessary evil. To maintain a modicum of humility, look in the mirror every morning and say, "I am an evil, but am I a necessary one?" The principle of equal and opposite unpopularity. If you've found the resolution of a problem that makes you popular with everyone or unpopular with everyone, you have the wrong resolution. If you have a resolution that makes you unpopular with half your constituency and popular with the other half, you probably have found a reasonable solution. The principle of appreciated cost. It always costs more than they say it will. The principle of controlled boldness. Be bold. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. But it's like the three rules for courting a woman. The first rule is be bold. The second rule is be bold. The third rule is don't be too bold. The final three principles come from a Russian fable. One cold winter, bitter day, the Russian peasant was walking home across the frozen steppes, and he came on a bird that was about to expire. He picked it up, put it under his coat, and set out to take it home with him. But on the way, he began to worry that the bird might have some terrible disease which would jeopardize his family, and he began to look for a safe place to put it. He came across what the British call a cowpat, and he put it down squarely in the middle of that, and revived by the warmth, the bird began to sing at the top of its lungs, and along came the ever-present Russian wolf and ate it in one bite. Now, this story has three morals, three lessons. The first is, if you get into trouble, don't despair. Help may be on the way. The second is, if you get out of trouble, don't be complacent, because you may not be out of the woods yet. The third is, if you find yourself in a real mess, keep your mouth shut. Nellie and I have done a great deal of traveling in our time, most of it on Cornell business and then later Washington business. But occasionally we took a trip for pleasure. 6 years ago, coming back from Australia, we stopped overnight in Los Angeles just in time for the Northridge earthquake. The airport reopened before noon, and our flight to Pittsburgh left on schedule. We knew we couldn't get into Ithaca because the airport was closed by bad weather. We knew we couldn't stay overnight in Pittsburgh because there were no hotel rooms as a result of all the canceled flights. So we took a chance on Syracuse and arrived there at midnight to a temperature of minus 10 and 2 feet of snow with only summer clothes and no top coats. There was another time that winter when Pittsburgh was closed. The terminal was wall-to-wall people and no hotel rooms. Three people fell into conversation with the camaraderie that's generated by shared adversity. One asked another, "Where are you from?" "I'm from Ely, Minnesota. It's a small town in the northern part of the state, about 100 miles north of Duluth. Gets pretty cold up there, doesn't it?" "Yes, it's cold all right, but it's a dry cold, and it's not too bad. Where are you from?" "I'm from Yuma, Arizona. It's a small town in the southwest corner of the state on the Colorado River. Gets pretty hot down there, doesn't it?" "Yes, it's hot all right, but it's a dry heat, and it's not too bad." Together they turned to the third person, and she didn't even wait to be asked. She said, "I'm from Ithaca, New York. It's a small upstate town. It rains a lot there, but it's a dry rain." It's impossible to be the president of a major university and not meet a lot of people, from the president of the United States down. You meet foreign dignitaries. I may be the only person in this room who ever sat at his bedside and discussed world affairs with Sir Anthony Eden when he had the flu. One person I came to know to some degree was the Philippine scholar, diplomat, soldier, Carlos Romulo. He had degrees from Columbia University and from Notre Dame. He was completely Americanized. He had been General MacArthur's aide at Corregidor and Bataan. After independence, he was the Philippine ambassador to the US and then to the UN, where he served as both president of the Security Council and of the General Assembly. When I met him, he was president of the University of Philippines. When I went to visit the Cornell Project at Los Baños, I called on him. And then later he came here for a couple of days and I spent more time with him. He left a big impression on me, partly because of his martini stories. One he told had to do with a man who'd had a hard day at the office and on the way home stopped at a bar. He ordered 5 martinis and lined them up in front of him, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the first one he took and just tossed over his shoulder. He drank the second, third, and fourth ones, and the fifth he tossed over his shoulder. The next day, it was the same routine. And when he paid his bill, the bartender said, "Why in the world do you throw away those 2 perfectly good martinis?" And his reply was, "The first one never tastes good, and that fifth one makes you drunk." There was another one about a young minister who was just starting out in his first church when the bishop came to visit one Sunday. And after the service, everybody went into the parish hall to have coffee, and the bishop took the minister aside and said, "Son, I may have heard a duller sermon than that in my life, but I can't remember when. I have a suggestion for you. Mix yourself a martini, put it in an ordinary water tumbler, set it there on the pulpit, and occasionally take a sip of it. I think you'll find this will relax you, and that's going to help your sermons." A year went by, and the bishop announced another visit. At the last minute, the minister remembered that he had never tried the advice, so he quickly mixed the martini, put it in a paper bag, and took it to church with him. After the service, everybody went into the parish hall for coffee, and the bishop took the minister aside and said, "Son, I have just 3 comments. The first is, you didn't have to put an olive in it. The second is, I said sip it, not gulp it. The third one is that Daniel slew the lion. He didn't beat the hell out of him." There's a third martini story that goes back to the McCarthy days in the 1950s. A university professor had been summoned to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee at the federal courthouse in Foley Square in downtown Manhattan near City Hall. The committee grilled him without mercy about all his leftist activities. He told them everything about himself but refused to disclose the names of any of his friends or colleagues. They threatened him with contempt and finally, in the end, ordered him to come back the next day. So he left the courthouse, walked down the street to Chamber Street, and around the corner he found a bar. He went in and ordered himself a double martini and sat there totally dejected, sipping his drink. And when he finished it, he started nibbling on the glass, and he nibbled it right down to the stem. The second day was worse than the first day, and they ended up citing him for contempt. And he left the courthouse, went back to the same bar, ordered another martini, sat there and drinking it in a totally dejected way, and again nibbling the glass right down to the stem. He looked up and noticed that the bartender was staring at him and said, "I guess you think I'm odd." And the bartender said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. The stem's the best part." Some of my most rewarding activities were in Washington after I retired in 1979. These involved various roles in the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, as Frank Press talked about, the National Science Foundation, the World Bank, the State Department, and the White House. I was once appointed chairman of the U.S. end of a U.S.-Japan bilateral agreement on basic research. The program was operated out of the National Science Foundation, and we did good things. The only trouble was the lack of funds. And it was a rewarding experience. I finally decided I was contributing too little to justify all the travel, and I sent a letter of resignation to the State Department office that had appointed me. A few months later, I received a reply back saying, "You cannot resign because your appointment has run out. But would you please stay on for another year?" Which I did. There are, or were then, about a dozen such bilateral agreements between the U.S. and Japan on science and technology policy. And there was an umbrella oversight group on which I served for a time. It was called the Joint High-Level Advisory Panel on Science and Technology. At the U.S. end, it operated out of the White House with the President's science advisor as the chief figure. The Japanese participants were bankers, former ambassadors, and other dignitaries. And it was absolutely the most useless body I ever served on. I've been to Japan a dozen or 15 times, but I've never traveled far beyond the Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka corridor. And I decided I'd stay on this panel for one more meeting in Tokyo and then do some traveling. But before the next meeting, the president's science advisor called me to tell me they were reorganizing the panel and reconstituting it completely with industrial people and retiring all the academics. So no travel in Japan. I had the most satisfaction out of my work with the National Academies of Sciences and Engineering, and I owe Frank Press a great many thanks for this opportunity. Although in the beginning of the research roundtable, I had a number of serious arguments with his governing council, who didn't like what I was doing, and Frank bore the brunt of these arguments because he got it from both sides, from me and from his council. In the end, it was mostly love and kisses. One day in 1982, I had a call from Frank's foreign secretary. He said that the World Bank was making a big loan to the People's Republic of China to strengthen Chinese science and engineering universities. And the bank had specified that there was to be an international advisory panel to oversee the loan operation. The chairman was to be an American who was to be nominated by the National Academy of Sciences, and was I interested? I said I might be, but I needed to know more. He said they would nominate two or three people and the bank and the Chinese would select. He would keep me informed. Several weeks went by and I heard nothing. Finally, he called again to say that the Chinese and the bank had accepted me, and a Chinese delegation would be in Washington in 10 days to meet with me. I ended up as the chairman of the panel with a Japanese physicist, a French chemist, a German engineer, a British computer scientist who was really Polish, and a Dutch biochemist who was really Australian. It was an interesting and unusual enterprise. I made 10 trips to China, each usually for 3 or 4 weeks duration. We also met numerous times in Europe and in this country with the Chinese. At the conclusion of this project, I continued on a similar panel for a second project, and altogether we helped spend about $500 million. Frank let us operate these panels out of the National Academy complex using all the built-in support structure that exists there. And looking back on it now, I shudder to think what would have happened if I'd tried to operate that out of my crowded little office in Clark Hall at Cornell University. Thank you, Frank. Altogether, I spent about 10 years in that effort. And in the 1960s, I had spent about 8 years as a Ford Foundation consultant helping build science and engineering universities in Latin America. I learned to do business in Spanish. but I can tell you I never learned to do business in Chinese. Now, just a word about Cornell. We survived the troubles of the late 60s and early 70s well. We succeeded because everybody pulled together. It was remarkable. I'm forever indebted to my administrative colleagues, the trustees, the deans, the staff, the department chairman, and the faculties who made it happen. Without that help and cooperation, I could have achieved little. I've been fortunate in the extreme in my life. It's light years from that one-room country school you saw on the video where I rode my horse 2.5 miles to school every day. And this room here tonight, I'm grateful. For Nellie and for me, thank you for your support during difficult times, and thank you for this symposium. It was an impressive session today, and we will enjoy every minute of it. Thank you.